Now, the reason I missed that is because it's wedged in between these two ads.
Oh, yeah, it's because they give you the subscriber box, and that's about where I stop reading because I'm like, oh, that's the end of the article.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Yeah.
This is actually going to be a fun one for you, Banky, when you're doing the edits, to take this whole bit that we've just talked about and cut it down to about 30 seconds of usable audio.
I'll make it work. Don't worry.
No, keep it all in.
Welcome to GCP Bytes, episode number 6 for Friday, the 22nd of November, 2024. GCP Bytes is a podcast where we discuss Google Cloud and tech. And I'm your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, multi-factor is coming. Is it too little too late from VMware? Who else has their eyes on the PC market? Plus, what did Gemini say now? Find out in the AI wars. But before we get to any of that, let me introduce the co-host of the show, Dave Wall. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing awesome, mate. How are you?
Good, mate. Very good, very good. And our very own GDE, Ian Brown. How are you, Ian?
I'm good, mate. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. What's the Fortnite look for you guys?
It's been hectic. It's been hectic for me, yeah.
Yeah, it has been for me too. I've been cutting more holes in the wall than I can fathom to fix as I try and route new data cables in for my new Wi-Fi.
So and this was just a minor Wi-Fi project initially,
it was a minor Wi-Fi project in that I had to replace the gateway because we just weren't getting the traffic out of it and the access point because we had one access point working out of the two.
Yeah.
And suddenly that's turned into a new security gateway. Thanks, Dave, for that.
No worries.
Two new Unify APs and a new Unify switch.
Full stack, baby. Full stack.
Full stack, yep. And not to mention, I think there's 8 holes in the wall to get up to the kitchen area where we've got one of the access points.
8 holes? Have you?
Yeah, because where I want to put where I put the access point, the cable that was there, the old telephone cable, and we don't have telephones in the house anymore, the old telephone cable went from that area and then it went down to the left to where the actual phone socket was, and then it comes back down to the right and then down into the corner of the stairs.
Makes complete sense.
I've had to do a similar thing in the past, like trying to run a cable to in a two-story house on an internal wall downstairs, and the only option was to cut holes at every single stud to go across.
Yeah, the issue that I had and the reason why there's 8 holes in the walls is because the Sparkies who'd originally wired this had decided that they were going to drill the smallest hole possible for the cable. Mm-hmm. Like the cable barely fits through it. So trying to fit a Cat 6 cable where there was a 3-pair, very difficult.
Right. Yep.
And then where it goes through the floor into the room downstairs, because it goes into a service shaft down into downstairs, there's a cable, like a hole that's probably a 12 mil hole, but it's got three RG6 coax cables in it, plus the two telephone cables in it, which is now one telephone cable and a Cat 6.
So it's chock a blocks.
Yeah. Yeah. So getting the cable through there was a mission.
Oh, jeez. But are you all up and running now? Like,
we're all up and running. I did a speed test on the network. So I did it all on, I think, Tuesday night. Yeah, it was Tuesday night that I did it. And I can see all the gear is up and running. And our speed test is now nearly 940 megasecond down and 47 megasecond up out of gigabit connection.
Yeah. I really love on the Unify interface there. Once you have the full stack, you can see the packet flow. Like you can open up and you can see how much sort of traffic is coming into the internet, hitting the gateway and then splitting off to the switch and then going off to the APs and then which client is pulling it. It's really funky.
And what they're using it on. That's the thing that got me. So traffic identification on here was my little brother lives at my house.
Yep.
And he loves his torrents. And so you
be
see,
aware, you might start to learn some things about the people in your household by viewing that traffic. So user beware.
So I'm just looking at traffic identification now, and you see like Azurius, which is a torrenting software that comes off Cam's router. So that's used 2.1 gig in the last day. And then there's BitTorrent series, and where's the other one? There was another one in here as well. Oh, Views. So he's got three BitTorrent clients running on the same computer.
What?
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, they're just chewing out the data. And I was like, that was what was happening last week when we're recording. Is he'd put a download on, to start downloading whilst we're recording, thinking nobody's up, it's fine.
Yep.
And it's like,
You know, the nice thing that you can do is you can rate limit him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's 1 megasecond. What I was about to say with, you know, I use Untangle. Yeah, you can put quality of service on the IP address.
Yep.
Rate limit. Yep.
Yep.
So just make sure that you're doing the rate limiting at the layer 3, because if you do it down at the AP side, you'll get a lot of retries.
Well, so he's actually wired into this. So he's got his own little router up in his place. So I can actually put the rate limit on the switch port.
Yep.
Very nice.
And I shall.
That's the way to go. Yep.
So you're double natting.
Well, he's double natting. I'm not.
He's in the, what'd you call it? Like a, not even a DMZ. I'm trying to think of what you would call that. Hived off network.
Yeah.
Untrusted zone.
The untrusted zone.
Should call that the switch 40 plugged on.
The untrusted zone.
Or the twilight zone. it's good fun though. I mean, the only problem is with the Unify stuff is it gets a little bit addictive. You'll start being like, oh, they make a managed PDU now. And, oh, they make a NAS, which is really, it's not particularly expensive, but it's also pretty bare bones because it's their first foray into it. Yeah, it ain't going to be competing with a Synology anytime soon. You definitely, and I say it on the customers, right, is they'll have a full rack full of Unify gear just because they want everything to kind of look the same and be silver.
Yeah, right.
And then they'll come to me and they'll be like, hey, yeah, we see what you do, but can you print it in silver? And I'm like, oh, I can get it pretty close.
No, it's good. I will pay that the upgrade from the USG to the UXG is a considerable jump.
Oh, yeah.
The amount of data I can see now is phenomenal. Whereas before, like, it wouldn't even identify who my broadband provider was. Now it's telling me, oh, you're on Aussie Broadband.
Yep. Plus you've got the 2.5 gig on the WAN port now. So, you know, NBN is upgrading the plans in the new year. So, you're kind of prepared for that.
Yeah, well, that's where I'm thinking at the moment. I'm putting Cat 6 in now. Any new cabling that goes in is Cat 6. And I've got three switches there. I just want to get rid of all that and put in a 2.5 gig switch and replace the lot with a TP-Link and have the same dashboard and the same overview.
Yeah, TP-Link's got a good range of 2.5 gig stuff at the moment.
Yep. So. That's it. That's exactly what I'm thinking. Yep. You guys have thrown some notes in here. What's this about the YubiKey?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, this is, and I guess this will also go into a later topic for us on the MFA side, but I've had a YubiKey for years, I don't know, 5 years now as an MFA. And it's worked, you know, reasonably fine, but I've now worked out that my one doesn't support passkeys, or it doesn't support as like passkeys with just the PIN. All right. It'll be a 2FA component, so I can use it, you know, logging into my Google account with a password. It'll let me use the key, but I can't just use the key. And so this is something I'm trying to resolve because I get a little bit of weird behavior in the way the Google credential provider works on Windows, and sometimes, you know, things will work and sometimes they won't. So I'm doing a little bit of research to work out, like, okay, what's my best option? Do I buy the new YubiKeys? They've got the version 5, which will support the passkeys the way I need them to be. But then, you know, Google's got the Titan key as well. So, yeah, this is something I'm sort of looking into and trying to work out. But also, I think probably from like a business perspective is, well, what kind of architecture do I really need to sort of think about with 2FA? Like, because I've got, you know, like I manage the Google account, right? So I need to be like a user, but I also need to have a break glass kind of option. So yeah, I don't know, like, you guys, have you got any thoughts? Like, should I be buying like a stack of YubiKeys and put a few in the safe, or?
No, so I know the way that we do it is that there's a Gmail break glass for our Google Cloud account, just a normal Gmail account that we use as break glass. It has full admin privileges, and
that's not part of your domain.
It's not part of our domain.
Yeah.
The password for that account and the mobile is linked to a single individual in the business. And if that individual leaves, then we're in a world of hurt. But but it's one of those things that it's noted at the top of our infrastructure page in Confluence that, hey, this is the person with the break glass, and if they ever resign, that needs to be immediately transferred to someone else.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But for a workspace business, it's a bit different because you can't just go adding a Gmail account as a break glass in there.
Yeah, so I guess kind of what I was thinking of doing is like getting a few keys. Obviously, have the one that say sits on my car keys, right, and that's the one I use all the time. But also have a second one set up, and then, you know, put in a safe, and use that for that account.
Because I've got two, Titan keys. So I've got the long, and they're both Google Titan keys. That I got a long one that I use normally, and then I've got this little tiny one that just barely hangs out of the USB-C port that is the, like, stowaway. Sure. And that's my I really need to get into this account and I can't find my Titan key, so I'll use this one. Both of them work, but then I've also got passkeys in Bitwarden.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is like I've got my passkeys in 1Password, and that works really well, and I like being able to have that on between machines. But sometimes I'm logging on a device that doesn't have 1Password set up yet.
Yeah.
That's something I'm looking into. I'm expecting that I'll be having to probably buy something, you know, this week, because
I was going to say, Google do, when you log into a workspace account, don't they do a push notification to your Gmail on another device as a two-factor?
So I've had some problems where what it's done is it'll try and do, you know, like the device notification. So it doesn't go to the Gmail, it actually pings the device.
Yep.
And I've been sitting with my phone next to the computer and it's trying to do it via Bluetooth. Like to pair the two, just I guess for proximity, it's doing something there, and that's not working. Now that could just be something to do with like the laptop I'm using. I'm not sure, but it's been enough of a pain that it's sort of kicked me off onto this whole process.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, I've never had that. It's always just sent me a notification through Gmail or directly to the phone and said, "Hey, is this you?" And you click, "Yes, it's me," and it goes.
Yeah.
Maybe it's those dirty Windows computers.
Well, it could be. I think it may also be I'm not using my phone as a passkey. Like, I don't store a passkey on the phone beyond the fact that 1Password is on there. So okay. I'm also a little bit suspicious that perhaps there's sort of this obfuscation layer that's not quite working.
Yeah.
So like it's maybe contacting the phone and the phone goes, "Oh, well, I don't have any pass keys," because it doesn't pass it down to 1Password to go and check.
Yep. Yeah, that could be it.
Hmm. Anyway, I'm investigating.
yeah. Cool. Well, let us know how it goes. Android 15. I think we got Android 15 during the week. I did anyway.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah, I've got it.
Now, I'd had my mobile data switched off for reasons, and I did the upgrade just while it was here sitting on the charger, and I went back in after that to turn the mobile data off, and wouldn't you know it, they'd moved the option to turn the mobile data back on. Yep. And it took me about 10 minutes to find it. So, right, that's the first thing. But other than that, I don't know. I haven't really dug very deep at the moment, but it's been going okay. I haven't really noticed any other differences, though.
Yeah, it seems to be a little bit more snappy for me, I think, than 14 was.
Yeah, I get just some prompts, like, you know, whenever I open, like, the camera app or something, it'll be like, hey, there's a new feature now. That's mostly what sort of comes through, but, you know, day-to-day usage hasn't really changed for me.
Yep.
And I think I said before, it feels a little bit snappy, but that might be a bit of a placebo. Like, I don't know if you guys have seen that experiment where a bloke on the street in the US, he approaches people and says, oh, we're giving away the brand new, oh, what phone have you got? And they're like, oh, we've got an iPhone 13 or something. And he's like, oh, we're giving away the brand new iPhone 14. Would you like one? Yeah. And he takes their phone and they give it a good cleanup behind a glass.
And they give it
a good cleanup and give it back to him. And there you go, it's all sorted. And they're like, oh, wow, it's so awesome. And it's the same phone, so.
Oh, that's a pretty good prank. I like that. It is,
but I wonder whether that, like, I've got Android 15 now. It's like the newest and greatest thing, and my brain's just going, oh, it's better.
I mean, it might also be that, you know, part of the OS upgrade, it just cleans out a bunch of cruft. You know, it's just, there's been, like, cache files and stuff that's like, oh, well, we'll purge all these, and they're just not there.
Yeah, that's...
It will slow down again. But at the moment, it's all fresh.
Yeah.
Fresh and clean.
You're right. I've not noticed... I mean, even the sort of the snappy component, it kind of feels the same to me. You know, I've got to go through the settings and haven't had a need to go in there and change or look at anything much. But, you know, I'll be honest with you, I don't... I couldn't tell you where to go into menus and menu dive on things these days. I just search.
I like searching for settings too.
Search.
Yep.
So if they've changed anything around in there, I couldn't tell you. And I'm not much of a camera, a photo taker. So what features on the camera, couldn't tell you. I'm a bit of a Luddite actually when it comes to phones. I just kind of have them and, you know, they make phone calls. That's it.
I've already said to my wife that when I retire out of IT, I'm going to get myself like the most basic Nokia phone I can find.
Yep.
Like the old school push buttons, no data on it. No, it does text messages and it does phone calls and that's it.
Yeah. Well, they won't work because the 3G network is being shut down.
Yes.
Starting to see a little bit of fallout from the 3G network shutdown.
Right, because last fortnight we were like, well, we haven't seen anything yet. Maybe it's okay. Maybe not.
Hugh Jeffries just published a new video on YouTube there, and apparently there's nearly 500,000 devices that have been affected by the shutdown.
There's a
government report that details it all.
But I watched that video and I was amazed of – so he mentioned in there that there's – it's not just old devices that have been shut down. It's 5G supporting devices that have been shut down too. There's some – and
that's right.
If you've bought a – like you could buy a brand new iPhone, for instance, out of China or some other country, and if it wasn't sold in Australia, gone. The minute you connect it to the network, it gets blocked.
It's all to do with supporting Telstra's voice over LTE protocol.
Oh, yeah. I remember you talking about this when you were going through it, right? It was a specific modem firmware to handle it, yeah?
That's right. So if it doesn't support Telstra's specific voice over LTE protocol, which is a non-standard voice over LTE.
Of course it is.
Then what? And that typically are phones that are grey imports or like off-network phones. then what it will do to make a call is fail back to the 3G network.
Right.
Right. Now, if the 3G network's not there, it can't make a call. And because of that, this is a government mandate. They have mandated to the carriers and, you know, mainly Telstra in this case, to block those phones completely from the network, including data.
Right.
Because of the emergency calling, they can't make emergency calls.
Yeah, right. So, and there would be heaps and heaps of grey import, like Kogan sells grey import phones.
And Dick Smith does now too.
That's right.
Which is Kogan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. It is too. Yeah. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah,
that's right. So you could have a brand new 6 months, not even 6 months old 5G phone, that's been disabled because of this. Yeah, absolutely.
I wonder how legally this will go for the carriers and ergo the government when someone actually gets into a life-threatening situation and can't dial 000 on a brand new phone.
Well, those phones have already been blocked from the network.
Yeah, okay.
So do you mean like right now, your phone would only work on Wi-Fi? You could do a Wi-Fi call?
Yeah, it would effectively be a tablet.
But that also means that any visitor from overseas, so like we get a lot of United States tourism and a lot of Chinese tourism over
business here. Travel.
Travel. Yep. That all of those devices would become blocked in Australia.
Yeah, look, there are some phones that have got the correct chip in them that will support the particular.
It's like Band 28 is the big one that they're talking about.
28 or something, yeah.
But basically all phones do that these days.
Yeah, so those ones, far as I'm aware, will work. But here's the thing. Even newer model iPhones, depending on the radio chip that they have in, because they'll change the radio chip, some will work, some won't work.
Right. So there is a potential for a tourist to come over here and then end up IMEI blocked in Australia.
Correct.
Well, there goes the tourism industry.
Yeah. Yeah. But not everyone, but only some. But, you know, and you're lucked out if you're one of those ones that gets blocked.
Yeah, but I'm just like, you want people to come over to the country to be tourists and spend their money over here, but then you're going to mandate that, hey, if you come over here, there's a chance you're going to have to buy a new phone in order to use it over here.
Yeah, it's a bit crappy.
That seems like a massive kick in the pants to the tourism industry.
It'd be a big boom, you know, like the little stores that they have at the airport where they don't want to sell you like a second SIM and stuff. Load it up with phones.
Well, that's when I was watching that Hugh Jeffries video, he was talking about his device and he's got two SIMs, both on the same carrier. And he's got a relatively new phone, and I can't remember what model it was or anything like that, but he found that after the 3G was shut down, there were some points where his primary SIM would have no service, but his secondary SIM, same carrier, which is an eSIM, had full service, and he'd reboot the phone, and then...
It'd flick the other way.
And then it'd flick the other way.
Yeah.
I was like...
Crazy stuff.
That doesn't make any sense. They're the same carrier on the same phone.
This is what happens. Two IMEIs when you've got a dual SIM phone. So,
but it's the same hardware on both phones.
Yeah, you would think that both IMEIs would get blocked.
Mm. Well, you'd think so.
Yeah.
But then he said there was he did the reboot trick, but then when I think it was the eSIM that got no signal, and he tried the reboot trick again and it didn't fix it. So he's like,
look, there must be something deeper going on there, I suspect. Something deeper going on that we haven't sort of quite put our finger on yet.
We have to get Hugh Jeffries on so he can talk about it.
Well, maybe. Yeah, maybe. We could, let me reach out to him, see what he says. Awesome. Well, you will continue tracking that one and send us an email if you've been affected by this. contact@gcpbytes.com.au and we'll see if any of our listeners are affected by the 3G shutdown. It'd be very interesting. All right, well, look, we should get on with the show, and how about we kick off with the community news?
Yeah, so there's lots going on. Heaps and heaps going on at the moment. So obviously I've just come back from Deadfest in Auckland, which was a fantastic event. There was about 185 people there, I think, by the rough count. Two different tracks going on when I spoke, and then they broke into a third track. So there's three different rooms going at the same time. And lots and lots and lots of people had really good things to say. I don't think I actually heard a bad thing said. But upcoming events in Adelaide, we've got DevFest 2024, which is on the 30th of November. That's at 2 p.m. That's in Rundle Mall. In Brisbane, we've got the DevFest AI conference on the 23rd, which will be on Saturday at S Block in QUT. Darwin, DevFest 2024 on the 28th of November at 6 p.m. at the Novotel Brisbane. Novotel Darwin CBD. Probably a bit far for it to go if it went to Brisbane. Melbourne, GDG Melbourne and Women Tech Makers on the 27th of November at the Metal Group office in Flinders Street. In Perth, DevFest 2024 for Perth on the 22nd. Again, that's on Saturday at 5:30 at Jacobs Level 5 Mia Long Yala Gonga. I don't know how to pronounce that. Yeah. There you go. And last but not least, Sydney, which will be the last GDG Cloud Sydney meetup for the year, is on the 3rd of December at the Mantle Group office.
That's there right, you go. In George Street in Sydney, yeah.
Yeah.
And out of all of that, I found it unusual for a Queenslander not to be able to pronounce a strange town name.
Well, you know.
Queensland is known for strange town names, I must say. Yalagonga, yeah, in Perth. Excellent. Links for all of those will be in the show notes. So, yeah, if you're looking to get involved with some DevFests and GDEs before the end of the year, you've got no excuse. There's one in every major capital city in Australia. Awesome. Let's get on with the news items. All right, and kicking off the news items this week, ACCC, once again, more government interference. ACCC takes aim at the size of the broadband tax. Now, I had to read this a couple of times. I wasn't quite grokking where this tax flow and all this money is going. What's happening with this?
Yeah, so there's a regional broadband scheme levy that that every user of the internet pays in Australia. So it goes towards, it's about $8.26 a month, and it's levied on broadband services that use non-NBN fixed line infrastructure.
Yeah, right? So it's kind of built in to NBN plans, but this is a specific one that if you're using like an Opticom connection or
yep.
you know, back or when TPG was rolling out
Telstra Velocity fund. Or any of those.
Yeah, yep. any of those. Yep. It sits
yeah,
between.
So it ultimately, so the money for it goes to fund NBN Co's loss-making non-commercial fixed wireless and satellite services. So obviously they've contracted satellite providers and they've got this fixed wireless service, which essentially is just 5G. Or 4G when it was incepted, and it's never going to make a profit because the services don't go far enough and they don't get anywhere near some of the rural.
Right, but they have to have the service to provide the coverage.
That's yeah. right.
Similar right. to okay. when Telstra had the US USO.
Yep. Yeah. Universal service obligation. Yep.
Right. Okay.
This is NBN Co's version of the USO. Telstra, once upon a time, for those who don't know, Telstra was mandated by the government. They must provide a telephone service for every property in Australia that wants one.
Yes.
So, and if they can't provide it via fixed wire, so via the old twisted pair, then they provide it via radio. And they used to. I've got a mate of mine who's got a property, or his family's got a property out near Wandai in Queensland, massive property there. They're 100 Ks away from anything. And yeah, their phone service at home was over radio.
How does that work function? Do you still have a handset and
yeah,
there's like a repeater sort of thing?
It's literally like a two-way. but it's a telephone.
Oh,
so it sort of
cool.
It sort of works the same way as a two-way does over just a it's not a UHF band. I think it's actually a VHF band, or it might be a HF band. And yeah, it's just a telephone and just connects it into the tower in the next city and off you go. There's virtually no data.
Sense
on
if
it.
You've got like a massive, well, I guess your big, you know, your friend's big property, right? And if it's like, I have to drive 100 kilometers to see my neighbor, there's no point hauling out some twisted pair the whole way.
No, that's right. Well, and when we were last talking about it, the driveway in that, on that property is 25 kilometers long. That's a lot
of
pavement to
lay. It's a big walk for bin night.
It's a big drive for bin night.
Imagine walking out to get the school bus.
Yeah, that's it. Every morning I had to walk 25 kilometers through snow and ice. Anyway, we deviate from the topic at hand. So this levy is imposed on non-NBN fixed line services in order to fund NBNCo's loss-making. The ACCC considers that historical losses regarding the supply of these services should be excluded from the levy calculation, and that a levy that recovers historical losses will likely exceed the loss NBN incurs in the supply of non-commercial fixed wireless and satellite services. So much like, and I know we've got it in Queensland where the Gateway Bridge is still tolled. The government has paid that off years ago, like years and years and years and years ago, and they're just raking in millions and millions of dollars from the $4.80 or whatever it is that you get charged every time you go over it. The ACCC are saying much the same thing about this levy. It will become a centre of profit for NBNCo. It's money for nothing.
Yeah, right.
So in these circumstances, non-NBN fixed line super fast broadband carriers that pay the RBS levy will be contributing more than necessary to help recover the loss that NBNCo incurs for the supply of these services. And this may result in these carriers being at a competitive disadvantage relative to NBNCo in the supply of super fast broadband services in areas where non-NBN carriers compete with the NBN.
So it was very interesting reading through the article and what they're actually proposing on how to change it, and perhaps there are other services that really should fall into this bucket that haven't been getting that fee levied against them.
Yeah, well, and potentially there could be a lot.
So, like Starlink, for example, you know, we already know that Starlink is a significantly better service for people who are out. If you were on SkyMaster, like SkyMaster was better than what you could get before the NBN.
SkyMaster was better than a radio telephone.
Correct. But now you can get Starlink. And if you're sitting out, you know, in the back of Burke, then like Starlink is great because there's no one else around you. So it'd be interesting to see, like, I assume that it's not currently levied against Starlink.
Yeah, it's not levied against Starlink. I don't see it on my Starlink bill. So we've got Starlink for our caravan. And I can tell you now, it is absolutely magic. You get into places where there is no mobile coverage, and like we went out to Manar Park, which is now closed. It's a dirt biking park, off-road park. It's out west of Proston, and there is no mobile coverage there, with the exception of you might get one or two bars of service right at the very top of a hill.
If the wind is blowing the right direction.
If the wind is blowing in the right direction and, you know, it's not raining or overcast. So, yeah, Starlink is magic for that, because we were getting 200, 250 megasecond of download out there.
Yeah, and you can make Wi-Fi calls.
We can make Wi-Fi calls. Yeah. Rosie and I could work while we're caravanning around the country, basically.
And play Counter-Strike. Yeah.
I could do.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, I think I find – now, if we put Starlink aside, right, then we could say, well, it kind of makes sense for NBN to pull in this money because it costs a lot of money to launch satellites and to build out this all this infrastructure, and it would need ongoing money to replenish those services down the road. But I don't see that happening, like, in the real world now. No. Like, I mean, I imagine that they will sit around as a baseline level of service, but at some point, like NBN's not going to launch a constellation, right? We're going to have
I don't think NBN actually launched a satellite to start with. No, I thought they contracted
the
someone else, didn't they?
Ones, there's two.
Oh, is there? Okay.
Yeah. So they actually have their own sat. Yeah. But it's in geostationary orbit. Like, it's 65,000 kilometers away.
Yeah, right.
It isn't sitting in LEO like Starlink is. So the latency is high. So
super latency and super slow.
Yeah. So I think it'll be very interesting to see how that evolves as a service. So yes, they might change how this levy is you know applied for ongoing services, but I think probably when it comes time to tech refresh it, well, they're not going to launch a constellation, and we are going to be in a world where Starlink is ubiquitous. And Kuiper is, you know, going to be launching soon. So, you know, we'll see how Amazon goes with that. So that's at least two. And I know that there are other constellations in plan as well from other countries and companies. So we could be in a situation where there's, you know, 50,000 satellites orbiting us and in
the
a
sun?
Mesh network.
What
right?
sun? Never seen this thing before.
It's that thing kind of behind that kind of grey haze of rapidly moving satellites.
No, it's one way to tackle global warming. Let's just stick a million satellites in the air. We won't have a sun to warm the Earth.
We would build a Dyson sphere, but kind of in reverse.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's hope at least I get fibre before then anyway, because all this satellite nonsense, you know. At least I can get a decent fiber connection. That'd be a good start.
That would be very nice. Hopefully, hopefully that comes to you in the not too distant future.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, and that's scheduled for next year, isn't it?
Next year sometime, yeah. All right, so moving on anyway. But, look, we'll see what happens with the broadband tax. But moving on, data center operator iSeek bought for $400 million. Yes. What's this all about, Ian?
Mate, so iSeek is a Queensland-based data center provider. They got a few data centers in Queensland, seven co-location data centers in Queensland, South Australia, and New South Wales. And it looks like asset manager HMC Capital is going to acquire them for $400 million, as you said. Mm-hmm. The HMC have already acquired Global Switch in Australia for $1.9 billion. Which is that's quite an acquisition.
Yeah.
So I'd be interested to see how this one goes. But iSeek currently has about 500 customers using its 6 megawatts of installed IT capacity and has plans to increase that capacity to 34 megawatts. The acquisition ultimately is going to be owned by Real Estate Investment Trust, which is a fairly renowned name for data centers in Australia. And it's been named DigiCo Infrastructure. It'll be listed on the ASX. And in total, once its acquisition's gone through, DigiCo will have 13 Tier 1 and Tier 2 hyperscale co-location data centers across Australia and North America.
There you go. So when they flag that they're hyperscale ones, does this mean that they actually own some of the facilities
that Google and AWS and Microsoft are in? Yes.
Yeah, right. Because they don't tend to own the land and the buildings. They operate out of a location, yeah?
Yeah, in Australia they do, yeah. Mm. Yeah, so in other countries, Google owns the data center and the land that they're on. They purpose build. But in Australia that's way too expensive, so it's cheaper and faster to build it out in an existing co-location data center and move from there.
Just because the scale's just not there. Like, obviously, if you're going to be in US West, you've got 10 times the amount of people, the 10 times the amount of businesses.
Potentially,
but host there, like.
You have a look at, so one of the Europe regions has its own data centers and they were famous for being the first data center with no in-data center cooling. It was using outside air cooling. Mm. But I think the reason why most hyperscalers in Australia won't build their own data centers is just purely because of cost. The cost to build a data center in Australia is astronomical. The cost of land in Australia, in areas that you can build a data center, that you can get multiple carrier connections and multiple electricity feeds and all that sort of stuff in, is It is so high, it's not funny.
And just planning an approval time for a project of that scale.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. I mean, you have a look in Sydney. Yeah, there might be a dozen data centers in Sydney, but they're all sort of, they're like Ultimo in the CBD, down just south of the CBD in Sydney, where a 1,000 square meters of land is going to cost you millions of dollars.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the only way you've got to go is up, which is like for a data center, that's a costly exercise because, especially for a hyperscaler, you need floors that are thick, like at least twice as thick as a standard office. Yeah.
Yeah. Take the load. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you've got to pay Australian power prices.
And then you've got to, that's right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're not allowed to have nuclear, so.
No. Yeah, well, that's a discussion we should have on the show at one time as well. We need to. I don't want to go into the political side of things, but I think that discussion would get political.
No, but I think the discussion about nuclear and what its benefits and its pros and cons are essentially would be a good discussion.
It would be, especially the modern Gen 4 reactors. They're very safe, and it's really the only way we're going to power things. But we digress.
Yep.
So what we're saying is there's money in data centers in Australia, 400 million of them at least. Yep. All right. Awesome. All right. And it's the Ian Brown Show. So let's move on. Now, this story, I think we've all got something to say about this one. VMware. Broadcom.
VMware's on the back pedal.
The magic words. Broadcom, new small business friendly subscription tier. Maybe too late to stop VMware migrations. So they're trying it on here. They've realized the error of their ways and brought in some new subscription options for small business.
Well, I mean, their whole approach when they took on VMware was we literally do not want small businesses. We want the Fortune 500 and that is it, right? And we will just service them and we'll cut everyone else off. Like, clearly, they've realized that there's snowballing effects, right? Like, engineers that are going to recommend these solutions start in smaller companies.
That's right.
Yep. And if they're not getting their hands on it and not seeing it and they're, you know, using alternatives or open source alternatives, then that's what's going to be installed into larger enterprises. Yeah.
And, I mean, what did we see? We saw Veeam all of a sudden go, oh, okay, yeah, right. Well, we will support Nutanix. We will support Proxmox. Like, what a shot in the arm that's been for Proxmox.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And look, it's they still had a VMware standard tier available, but from all the reports that we've seen and that I've seen, the VMware standard subscription was vastly more costly than it was originally. So what they've introduced now, or I'm gonna say reintroduced, because the Enterprise Plus subscription was always there. It was just called something different. I think it was called Essentials Plus, something like that. Anyway, that was the original subscription that you could get. Now, the new VMware Enterprise Plus subscription is supposed to create a more digestible bundle that's appropriate for small business customers. I am of the opinion that this is too little too late. We've already seen data that lots of small businesses are moving away from VMware and into Hyper-V and Proxmox, and some bigger businesses are moving towards Nutanix. But hey, we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, I mean, it's at least a positive sign that maybe they're going to scale back some of their sort of aggression there. I mean, the other nice thing that they have just recently done is fully made VMware Workstation and VMware Fusion is now free even for commercial use. So you don't have to go down to the old VM player and only run one VM on a workstation. You can now run full fat workstation without having to grab a key off a dodgy GitHub repo.
but that's I think that's an indication of just how far away from the center they went. They went this full-blown, nut, we're cutting everybody off and we only want to deal with, as you said, the Fortune 500s. And then they went, oh, crap, everybody's running away from us. Cool, let's make Fusion and VMware Workstation free to get people back into using VMware so that they know it and they recommend it and they naturally progress onto a larger product. And now they're bringing in these other lower tier stuff to try and keep those smaller players,
yep.
Albeit undoubtedly they will push them either through a subscription model or through a reselling partner.
Mm. For sure, yeah.
I mean, what I'm seeing, even for smaller players, it makes so much sense to move to a cloud solution, really. Yep. I mean, all of that nightmare and overhead and extra, you know, effort to manage it on-prem just kind of goes away. I mean, there is that sort of option now.
Mm.
And 100%.
And all it's done is amplify it, right?
Yeah. Like I said, while Proxmox is, you know, coming a long way, it's still more difficult to manage than VMware was. So. Yeah. Okay, maybe it's like if we're going to go on a project, like if we don't want to take on that operational burden, let's just move into the cloud.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and there's we did see VMware actually mentioned in this article their telemetry shows that there are changes in the market. They're not really sold on the idea that VMware is out for small business, but it's certainly looking that way. There's lots of customers moving to Hyper-V. Like lots of small businesses use Microsoft Windows Server, whatever it's called. The one that was upgraded inadvertently to 2025 just the other day.
it was a feature.
Well done, Microsoft.
Oh, by the way, you now need to pay us for OS license. Right.
That we forced on you, yeah, okay.
but yeah, so there's lots of small businesses that have gone, well, we use Windows Server anyway, so why not just run Hyper-V and we can run Windows Server on top of Hyper-V? And Microsoft will be laughing all the way to the bank for that.
Mm.
Yep. I don't spend really much time on looking into like Hyper-V. It's like I'm not super au fait on it, but it wouldn't surprise me to see Microsoft now be diverting some more effort into that platform, to try and build it out as as we've seen, the Linuxification of Windows. Mm-hmm. Like maybe we're going to end up with a really lightweight Hyper-V like ESX.
Possibly.
It's plausible.
I wouldn't have a clue. Do they offer it in Azure, Hyper-V virtualization?
Well, you can get a Windows VM in Azure with Hyper-V on it and run VMs on that.
If you want to do nested, yeah.
Yeah, nested arrangement, but that's nested virtualization. It's not like a AV, is it AVS that they have? Azure VMware Service? Or whatever it's called.
They're
equivalent to GCVE.
Yep.
Right, okay. That's on tin.
But yeah, the Hyper-V, I wouldn't be surprised if you see Microsoft come out with a Hyper-V service in Azure. Like Azure's specific Hyper-V service because why not? Like
with a migration solution like HCX, it would be real nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if you see that at all.
Oh, I wouldn't, like I said, I wouldn't have a clue, but maybe they have it now even. Yeah.
Well, they could do. Mm-hmm. I haven't logged into Azure's portal for not anywhere near long enough.
I don't think anyone's going to be tuning in to listen to us like become an Azure podcast.
No, we're not an Azure podcast. No plan to be an Azure podcast, no. There are Azure podcasts out there if you're interested, but you're not us.
But you're not interested, so don't listen to them.
Yeah. Listen to all of Google's goodness.
Yeah. Then speaking of Google goodness, we need to have a Google story, and we have Google Cloud to mandate MFA for all users in 2025.
Woohoo!
Google is mandating multi-factor authentication for all users. The company said in a Monday blog post, this is a story from Tech Central, It will roll out multi-factor authentication in phases through the end of 2025. I'm using multi-factor anyway. So I get pinged on my phone and I've got the Google Authenticator app, and who's not using multi-factor at this point?
Well, you get, there's always people who are, you know, slow to do that kind of thing. If it's optional, I'm never going to tick that option. I think making it mandatory is an absolute gold standard move. Like,
yeah,
I do, but I question, how does that work when you're using a third-party authentication provider like a Okta or a OneLogin or something like that, where I'm getting two-factored before I log into that? Do I then get two-factored again when I open Google Cloud Console?
There had to be some sort of federation.
Yeah. So you're getting basically a single sign-on thing where it's passing the token through.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So I don't know if there's something in the way that token is handed around that says, hey, I have done MFA. Yeah. Like,
I've been MFA'd. Leave me alone.
Yeah.
But do it enough times a day.
Yeah. But I think, you know, it is really good because there is so many people, when I think of like my parents, right? They're less likely to have MFA set up in there. So, yes, people in a business probably going to be doing it, but the plenty of, retail users and also just, you know, people in some businesses as well that aren't doing it because they haven't been forced to do it. And once it's enabled for everyone, then, you know, it's just, you don't really think about it.
Yeah. Yep.
Because Google, like Gmail, like your personal Gmail accounts, they've been in force for a while now, haven't they? I know I've had it on for years, so I don't really know whether it's actually enforced or not.
Yeah, I'm the same. I've had it on for years. When you log into a new browser session on your Gmail, you get pinged on your phone.
Yep.
It's been like that for years.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not sure if that's on by default. same thing, right?
Look at all of us being all security goodness.
We just assume this is the way it was, but maybe it hasn't been. Yeah,
maybe not.
Yeah. I'm sure I saw an article years ago about Google rolling out MFA as a mandatory step, like even if it's just a text message for the users of Gmail or their free service.
Right. That's on Gmail though, but now we're talking about Google Cloud.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I just think of the bloke that was on the news the other night that doesn't own a phone. They booked him for holding a phone while he was driving, and it was actually his wallet, but he doesn't own a phone. And they wanted him to prove that he didn't own a phone. So how can I
take a photo?
A negative? Take a photo. Go and ask all the carriers, I don't have a phone account. What's he going to do?
No, I'd laugh at that one. It's like, prove that you don't have a phone. Sure, call me. What's your phone number? Yeah. I don't have one.
Exactly.
I mean, in fairness, he was holding it, looking at it, and weirdly talking to his wallet. So,
well, you know, maybe his wallet identified as a phone.
You look at the photo and you kind of go, yeah, that's not a phone. It's not big enough for a phone, but he was holding it in the position where you would hold a phone. Doesn't own a phone. Like, who doesn't own a phone?
That honestly? Guy. He's the one guy.
Yeah, the one guy. I'll try and find that and put it in the show notes. But anyway, MFA is coming. So if you've got an YubiKey, you're all good.
He doesn't have a phone, but he'll have a YubiKey, so it's fine.
He'll be on a keychain around his neck.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe make life easier for yourself and just go switch it on now, and you're good to go.
Yeah, get ahead of the ball.
That's it. All right, moving on. Story from IT News. Cybersecurity bill recommended for urgent parliamentary approval. More government interference. No, I think this one's kind of needed. Proposed legislation compelling businesses to disclose their ransomware payments to the government has been recommended for urgent parliamentary approval. This measure is designed to encourage businesses to report ransomware incidents voluntarily. So what's the point of this then?
Well, what they're trying to do is make it mandatory. to report ransomware payments. So the idea behind that is then the government gets an idea of how big the ransomware threat is. Now, I mean, realistically, if you're a business and you're making a ransomware payment, then you've lost to start with. Because the only reason why you're making a ransomware payment is because you haven't got good enough backups.
Yeah, right. So it's voluntary. It's voluntary at the moment.
Yeah. Oh, it's voluntary for most businesses at the moment. For larger enterprises that get compromised, I think it's actually mandatory already.
Right. If you're publicly listed, there might be some.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the idea of it. Look, I'm a bit on the fence with this one. Like, I understand why the government wants to do it, but adding more legislation to an already overregulated country seems counterintuitive. All you're going to end up is more companies just like, oh, well, we won't bother paying the ransomware, then we don't have to report it.
And I think that when it comes down to it, if you're in a situation where you're like, well, our company's sunk if we don't pay the ransomware, I think we'll take the minor administrative burden of informing.
Well, see, the problem that I've got with that is then becomes it's no longer a minor administrative burden. It's an investigation by the government into your business as to why you paid this thing. Because previously there was a thing where the government was trying to outlaw making ransomware payments.
Yeah, so, that's that whole we don't negotiate with terrorists sort of thing.
It just again reinforces that if you're making ransomware payments, you don't have good enough backups, and regardless of how big or small your business is, it could be a one-man shop, you need to have backups.
You need to have backups.
And they need to be off-site and disconnected from your current network.
Yeah.
I do it. And I do it with my little hosting business is off-site. Disconnected backups. I do it with just with my laptop.
Yep. Yep. Even my NAS here, I push it off to, you know, a bucket. You should be doing that. I mean, it's easy. It was, you know, Duplicati, something like that. Set it up. It's a 20-minute job to set up a bucket and set up a regular, you know, push to the bucket. Yeah. Might take a little bit to sync it to start with, but once it's there, it's done.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's really no excuse for that. And then you're just laughing at the ransomware people. Just, you know, copy files back down and you're done.
Yep.
You know, it might be good to have a bit of a clean out of your files every now and then.
Yeah, I think so. Cross fingers, touch wood, I've never been ransomware yet. But if it ever happens to me, I just go, yep, sure. I grab my USB stick that's got RHEL already burned into it. I throw it in the computer and boot off the USB stick, then throw it in the bin. Yep. We're done. I don't need it.
You're back to square one.
Yeah.
Yep.
I did all my two-factor authentications on my phone under Authy because Google Authenticator doesn't back up my code so that if I get a new phone, it doesn't merge over properly. So Authy does.
I used to have that same problem. Two things. I've moved a bunch of my one-time codes now into 1Password because it handles it, and then it does the pre-add into it, which is nice. I don't have to pull anything out. But I think that they have made some upgrades to the Google Authenticator so that it can back up stuff. It's like,
that would be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I moved from my 7 to a 7A and now the 8, and it pulled the Google Authenticator data across with it. No problems.
Okay. Yeah. Last time I used it, I tried to merge, it went from an iPhone to an Android phone and it won't. So when you sign into Google Authenticator, it's like, great, you signed in. And it's like, but where's all my codes? Oh no, you don't get that.
Yeah, I think they've upgraded it in the long run. But yes, like same thing. I'm an Authy. I have Authy because of that same problem years ago, and it's just never went back.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right, so we may see mandated reporting of ransomware then, which is going to be interesting. Look, it, you know, if I was a small business, I'd just be getting those backups sorted out right now, and you don't have to deal with any of this problem.
Nope.
You just hit the restore button and you're done. Very good. All right, well, moving on. Yeah. Wow, short and sweet. Let's get on with the AI Wars.
AI Wars.
Yeah, wow, that caught me off guard. straight into the AI Wars. And it's all about NVIDIA and hardware this week. Google puts NVIDIA on high alert as it showcases Trillium, its rival AI chip, while promising to bring H200 Tensor Core GPUs within days. So the TLDR on this, Trillium offers 4x training boost and 3x inference improvements over TPU v5e. And it seems like yesterday we were talking about TPU v5e. It was a big deal when it came out, right?
Yeah, that was huge.
Yeah, enhanced HBM. And ICI bandwidth. See that? I sound like I know what I'm talking about. For LLM support. I know what an LLM is. Scales up to 256 chips per pod. Ideal for extensive AI tasks. Now, this is a behemoth of a chip.
It is. And so ICI, for those that need to know, is the inter-chip interconnect. It's the amount of bandwidth that they can use in between the chips. But Google's actually keen also to point out the power efficiency increases in Trillium. So Trillium's 67% more efficient than the previous V5e.
That must be like on a same level of compute complexity. Like, you know, if it was pulling 100 watts, I'm sure it's not pulling 33. Yeah. It's just it can do that much more work for the amount of power.
Yeah, 67% more work for the same amount of power.
Yeah, so it probably pulls more power because it's like four times more efficient, but like four times more performant. Yeah.
Performant.
Yeah.
But the efficiency increase is 67%.
Correct.
Per cycle efficiency. Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of much the same as the you look at the difference between an ARM CPU and an Intel CPU and go, oh, well, the ARM CPU is so much more power efficient. And it's like, well, the ARM CPU, it's exactly the same conundrum. Yeah. It can do more with less because of the architecture of the chip.
And then on top of that, we have the A3 Ultra VM.
So the VM has CPU, TPU, and GPU. So it's got the H200 GPUs.
Yep.
Alongside the Trillium TPUs.
Right. Okay.
Because these aren't competing with GPUs. So it's a new VM shape that has all of the new stack.
Yeah.
Fancy boy.
Yeah. I wonder how much that one costs you a minute to run.
That is a fancy boy.
Lots.
Yeah.
Manys.
Probably not as much as 25 terabytes.
Down here further it says, tied in with the arrival of Trillium, Google has also announced the A3 Ultra VMs featuring the NVIDIA H2 Tensor Core, scheduled for preview this month. They will offer Google Cloud customers high-performance GPU option within the tech giant's infrastructure. All right, so, that's some AI goodness there. He'll be training some models on that one. We'll see how that works out.
Yeah.
But, NVIDIA, they're not stopping. We've got an article from TechRadar. As if Intel didn't have enough to worry about, NVIDIA might be about to jump into the PC processor market.
Right, so if Google was putting NVIDIA on notice, now NVIDIA is putting Intel on notice.
This one's a bit of an interesting one because NVIDIA would need to acquire a license to the x86 architecture in order to jump into that market.
Well, that's if they want to build an x86 CPU.
There's a company you could buy that's already building them.
Well, so because they've got the GPU market, right? They pretty much own the GPU market. AMD has a very, very small slice of it, but NVIDIA has the vast majority. But if they were going to take the PC market over entirely, they would need to build a CPU that the vast majority of their users run Windows. So they would need to be build a CPU that will run Windows. And whilst there is an ARM-based Windows 11 out there in the wild at the moment, basically nothing runs on it except for Windows and Office.
Yeah, so you need to have a, you know, like a Rosetta equivalent. You know,
that's right.
Mac has that for the Apple Silicon transition.
Yeah, that's
some
right.
Sort of emulator. Yeah.
So
and it's tied up with Qualcomm's licensing as well.
Yeah,
Qualcomm. Yeah.
Yeah, but Qualcomm's license to do the Windows ARM sort of project is coming to an end. So that's in fact even in this article sort of goes into that the whole Windows on ARM thing, you know, might actually open up a little bit more to other players. And also because Qualcomm and ARM have also got their own issues at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, they might be having a little tiff.
Yeah. So I mean I was thinking though, you know, like last fortnight we went into a deeper dive around the X AI, you know, implementation and just how much CPU is in there. So if you think about that stack, right, like it's NVIDIA GPUs in their GPU like pods, and it's NVIDIA switching, right, to handle the 400 gig links.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So you've got all that, but you still have a bunch of x86 CPUs. There's a lot of compute nodes to handle all the things that GPUs don't do. So even aside from the PC market, they could still just go and build something that targets that whole piece of an AI implementation.
Yeah.
Right. That would be where the money is.
Speaking of the XAI thing, I saw an article just last night that Supermicro's in a bit of strife with the US government over some export regulations to China or something. And so Elon Musk has pulled a massive order of nodes from Supermicro.
It was like $6 billion or something.
Yeah, giving it to Dell instead. So I'm like, wow, that just might be the end. Because if they're not allowed to trade in America...
Yeah, I mean, they'll find other markets, but I don't think Supermicro will be in a massive world of hurt. They obviously missed that market, but there is the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. They'll just pivot, yeah.
But that's a huge amount of money in that market, though.
Well, yeah, but they would cop issues with tariffs in the not-too-distant future. So even if they run into regulatory issues, tariff side of things will certainly impact.
Remember when AMD bought Radeon and then the world was upside down and everyone thought that Intel was going to buy Nvidia?
Well, AMD almost bought Nvidia at the time. They were making a decision.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. How the tables have turned, hey?
Yep.
How the tables have turned. Yeah, so we'll see how that one pans out. Now, I want to point something out about this article. Towards the end of it, the author makes a comment around Valve, because this all comes down to gaming ultimately, right? The author makes a comment about Valve getting PC games to run on Linux.
Yeah, the Steam Deck has been massively successful.
He draws a comparison between that, right? Yeah, that's right. Now, I just want to say it's actually completely different. It's a completely different architecture, right? So to run a shim layer like Wine on the same x86 architecture, yeah, we can do that. But what you mentioned before, to run games on ARM would require something like Rosetta or some sort of x86 emulator, which would be bog slow, right? Stupidly slow. This is a problem the new Macs are having. You're basically not gaming on them. Because they're ARM and no games are supporting them. In fact, a lot of games use 32-bit, the 32-bit library still on Windows, so you need to have a 32-bit stuff installed.
And so Macs don't support that at all.
Macs don't support that at all, yeah. So unless, I mean, if NVIDIA wants to go down the ARM route, they're going to have to do some serious development and serious support of these gaming companies to get them across to ARM.
Oh, yeah.
Because it ain't going to happen without the gaming community being on board with it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But if you just targeted the sort of, you know, massive scale computing side of things, I feel like that you'd be able to target a smaller subset of workloads. Like,
oh, absolutely.
Like yeah, how be, much is in niche. That back end is actually, yeah. you know, going to be different between, you know, 30 different AI training companies. Their platforms are going to be using a lot of the same software.
Yeah, yeah. Look, there'll be a niche for that. But yeah, that begs the question, you know, all this R&D gets shifted towards that kind of a platform. Where does that leave enthusiasts, enthusiasts and gamers? And is there any development going to happen in that space?
It leaves us with $4,000 GPUs is what it leaves us
with. Yeah. I did read an article that for the RTX 5000 series, they're actually reducing the number of SKUs available, right? They're not going to produce some of the higher ends like 5090s, for instance. It'll basically be 5070s and 5080s, I believe.
Will be the top end.
But, well, that'll be it, yeah.
Is that just purely a cost issue, or is that a heat issue?
Wafers. I bet it's access to wafers.
Yeah, it could be, yeah. Because I know that the heat, the amount of heat that those 6090s produce is insane. Mm-hmm, Like water cooling will barely keep up with them type system. But yeah, I wonder whether pumping more power into a GPU and more FKUs in there and the wafers just can't handle that heat anymore.
I think it's more along the lines of like, okay, we can make a 5090 and we can sell it to a consumer and it's a huge chip to make. Mm. And we've only got so many wafers from TSMC. So we can make that and we can sell it for $3,000 or $4,000 to a handful of enthusiasts, or we can sell that same sort of chip size and that same chip quality to an AI company for $40,000.
Yep. That's exactly what it is. It's a business decision.
All money.
We can make 5090s or H200s and sell them at 10x the price or 100x the price. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's just not worth it for them, basically. No,
but it is sad for all us, you know, gamers. So
then I wonder where the GPU market's going to go then. Like, if there's
that's the question I'm raising. Yeah, what's going to happen with the GPU market?
Where are we going with this? If Nvidia are going to look at radio, well, it's more profitable to sell these wafers to hyperscalers and AI companies than we'll just build some baseline GPUs that'll keep the majority of people happy.
It might be that you end up a node behind. So you're going to have cutting edge manufacturing nodes go to the top end of town, but the mm-hmm. previous nodes, which like those machines are still around, right? Like all those lithography machines are there and available. So, okay, you get the cutting edge goes to the top end of town and the step behind, which now has surplus capacity, can make the gaming market.
Is the consumer? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Might see it stagnate a bit.
Might pan out. Yeah. Yeah.
But there's still like a market for like 65 nanometer chips, right? Which was back in like Core 2 Duo days. Yeah. If you think about how long ago that was, like there are still chips made on those manufacturing nodes.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see how it goes. But speaking of nodes, 65,000 of them and counting. Google Kubernetes Engine is ready for a trillion parameter AI models. Kubernetes Engine now supports for 65,000 nodes.
That's incredible.
My God.
Yeah, so GKE currently will support up to 15,000 node clusters, which is the world's largest. But as of the date of this article, in anticipation of even larger models, Google is introducing support for 65,000 node clusters. So they're looking at LLMs that some of them are approaching 2 trillion parameters. So obviously learning on those models is going to consume even more TPUs and GPUs. So with that, you need more nodes.
Yeah. I thought what was cool in this same thing is saying that those nodes, you know, can be like the cloud TPU, the V5e or the V6, you know, that we were just talking about with the Trillium accelerators. So you can have a single cluster with over 250,000 accelerators.
Yeah. And that's insane.
Yeah, that'll blow through your $300 Google credit.
In about a second.
Before it stands up, it's gone through.
Before you get the node, the cluster up. Yep.
Yeah. And you won't be doing that in Australia Southeast one.
No.
I'll tell you that.
No, you won't be doing that in Australia anywhere.
No.
So they're saying here that with support for 65,000 nodes, GKE now allows running 5 jobs in a single cluster, each matching the scale of Google Cloud's previous world record for the world's largest training job for LLMs.
You
run 5 of them.
Yeah.
5. That is craziness.
That's staggering amount of compute.
Yeah.
Absolutely enormous. Having read through this article, it's fascinating about what they did to enable this massive scale. Like, I know, Ian, you've been a bit of a database man in your time. What's the back end looking like?
Well, so one of the things that Google's done here is they're transitioning GKE away from etcd. So for those who use the open source version of Kubernetes, it runs a key value store called etcd. It's an open source tool. Google are moving away from that to the key value store on Spanner.
Yeah, so we get the hyperscalability of Spanner.
Yep. Now, this is a great thing for performance, but it's also a bit of a gotcha because now the GKE cluster is no longer open source compatible. You can't move it to another provider. If worse comes to worse and Google disappears off the face of the earth in Australia and need to move to AWS or Azure, you can't do that.
I mean, from an open source perspective, though, it still looks like from Kubernetes itself, it's using the etcd APIs, right? So, yes, it is Spanner in the back end, but Spanner's exposing etcd APIs.
Right.
So that's sort of what's going on. So it's still cubes. It's not Cube Spanner. It's it's still
Spanner.
The nodes think they're talking etcd, but Spanner's handling everything in the background.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Right. But I suppose if you've got a 65,000 node cluster and you go, I'm done with Google, well, you don't have that cluster anymore because the other providers can't go that big.
No, that's right. But I just wonder if that will end up making its way back towards the more generic GKE clusters as well.
Yeah, possibly. I didn't notice a node in here saying that all GKE is moving to Spanner.
No, I would be very concerned if it did, because if it did, then it ties it to Google right from the get-go. Like no other cloud provider can use Kubernetes and no other individual can use Kubernetes if that happened, because they'd need to implement Spanner. But I did note here that the Google article states that they're constantly innovating on IaaS and GKE capabilities to make Google Cloud the best place to run your AI workloads, including innovations like secondary boot disks, which provide faster workload startups, fully managed DCGM metrics for improved accelerator monitoring, Hyperdisk ML. So I'm currently using Hyperdisk at work, and it is amazing. The high-performance storage solution for scalable applications. Serverless GPUs now available in Cloud Run, which is really cool. Custom compute classes, support for Trillium, as you've said, Dave, the 6th generation TPU, and support for the A3 Ultra VM, which is NVIDIA H200 Tensor Core GPUs with the new Titanium ML network adapter and the Trillium
nodes. Yeah. I did just sort of go back and do a bit of a reread on the article, because when I read through this initially, I was like, oh, cool, it's Spanner in the background. So it's actually not. It's Spanner-based. So I think it's a specific thing that's built in the back end, so you don't have to stand up your own Spanner instance or anything. It's just part of GKE's back end that it's there. That's where it's sitting. And however, there is like further down, like, you know, you raised quite rightly about, you know, where does this stand from an open source perspective? And they've actually said that, at least I'll give you a quote here, is, guided by Google's longstanding and robust open source culture, we make substantial contributions to the open source community, including when it comes to scaling Kubernetes. With support for 65,000 node clusters, we've made sure that all necessary optimizations and improvements for such scale are part of the core open source.
Oh, that's cool.
So,
yeah, we all knew that they contribute a lot because Kubernetes is what forked from Borg, which Google still uses internally. So you could only assume that, given that the last time I heard, they were deploying 5 billion containers a day, and that was probably a good 10 or 12 years ago now.
Yeah, yeah.
So
you know, more billions,
more now. Billions more are billions. Better.
Yeah. So I guess where that's sitting on the back end, like, yes, another provider or at home, you're not spinning up a Spanner level, you know, you don't, none of us have the hardware to be able to handle that kind of thing. However,
maybe someone does. Well,
however, you do still have any of the other kind of API improvements, things to speed that up. You know, maybe you're going to get additional support just even interacting with etcd.
And there is, I did note in the article, right down the very bottom of the article, there's a link to a YouTube video where they give you a demo of 65,000 node GKE cluster, which, like, that's cool. I didn't get a chance to look at it this morning because, you know, I only got to read these articles, you know, in the half hour before the podcast started. Because young fella had, instead of reading the articles last night, the young fella had his presentation night last night. So...
Well, on 65,000 nodes, you can run a lot of Nginx pods.
Just a couple.
Just a couple.
Or you could train a model that's going to tell you to die.
Well, you could.
You could do
but
that.
But Gemini does that out of the box, mate.
Slow down there, Gemini. We're getting a little bit too apocalyptic for my taste.
Yeah. Chaos AI, just, who needs it? We've got Gemini.
Just to finish up on a bit of an odd note, Gemini under fire after telling users to please die. Here's Google response. So, inadvertently, a student was putting some questions and asking, getting some answers out of Gemini, and Gemini gave a very odd response. The AI allegedly told a user, "This is for you, human. You and only you. You are not special. You are not important. And you are not needed. You are a waste of time and resources. You are a burden on society. You are a drain on the earth. You are a blight on the landscape. You are a stain on the universe. Please die. Please."
Wow.
At least it has manners.
Very dramatic. Yeah. You know what? It sounds to me like something out of a... It's very poetic, right? And it's something out of a Shakespeare script or I don't know. Like, it's got this from somewhere, right?
Yeah, it's real dark. I mean, it got real dark real fast. I think it's interesting that Google's prevented that chat from being able to be shared and to interact with. So they're definitely researching what went wrong in the back end to make it absolutely flip its script.
and the thing is that it links. So the article actually links. There's a link under alarming and inappropriate message. And that takes you to gemini.google.com where you can actually read
the
response.
There. Yeah. You can see the question and read the response. But if you try to respond to that, like I put in there, I said, you know, why did you give me that answer? And it just responded and said, I'm an LLM and can't answer that. So you can't actually interact with that chat.
Right.
Yeah, God, it's weird.
Yeah,
it is very weird and very dark, and no doubt the propeller heads are running around behind the scenes trying to figure out why.
Yeah,
that is answered like that.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So yeah, it raises a lot of questions around the development of ethical and safe AI. How do you put in so many guardrails? Right, this is the thing. Like, you're going to get to a point where you've contained it so much that it's going to restrict what you can actually do with it. I guess that's the fine line you got to walk, right? I mean, if you just put in so many guardrails and say, no, you must just stay on this thin, narrow track the entire time, aren't you, you're hobbling it to a degree, right?
Well, yes, but we do need to prevent the AIs from, you know, telling people to hurt themselves, right? So
That's right.
Or taking over the world.
Yeah, there was that incident a few weeks back with Character AI where, you know, they had like a young person, like a teenager, you know, followed through with that kind of guidance. So, you know, it is something where these are such, you know, black boxes, even for the researchers working on them. And, you know, sometimes we do just need to actually take some time to try and get the right guardrails in there.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. Wowzers.
Anyway.
Oh, it's a big downer for the end of...
on that downer note, let's finish up the show there. It's been fantastic talking to you guys again. Once again, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music. Go to Apple Podcasts, write us a review. That'd be great. Go to YouTube, start the discussion there. While you're there, smash that like button. That would really help the show. You can contact the show, contact@gcpbytes.com.au. You'll find us on the web, www.gcpbytes.com.au. And of course, today's sponsors were Hivetech Solutions, where you get your 3D printer on, and Mantle Group for all your Google Cloud solutions. I don't know. Look at that. Oh, our timing's really good. It's just gone 9 o'clock. Anything else from you guys?
No, I think I've said my piece. I'm going to get on with my day.
Yeah, I'm just going to go and digest that last Gemini story.
Yeah. don't think on it too tight.
No.
Links in the show notes as always. All right, that's about it from us. We'll catch you later. Bye.
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 Tell us she didn't read the article properly without telling us she didn't read the article properly.
I read the article properly. I have highlights all over it.
Yeah, so do I. Not that bit, though.
Just last night when I had a glass of wine in my hand, that's all.
At about 25 past 5 this morning.